Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello there, a very good afternoon and welcome to Liveline. On 551 if you want to get in touch with us. On text, it's liveline at rte.ie and it's 087 484 8888 on WhatsApp if you want to get in touch with us too as well. I'd love to hear from you. The breaking news we're hearing from the lunchtime news there is how the Department of Agriculture has announced a compulsory housing order now for poultry and captive birds amid the heightened risk from avian influenza, the dreaded bird flu. Nigel, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, John.
Thanks very much for talking to us on Liveline, Nigel. How many chickens are you raising on your farm?
We're raising approximately 100,000 birds on our farm.
Right. That's big business, Nigel.
It's a family business. It supports my wife, Bernice, and myself work on the farm. And we have 5 sheds on the farm in total. Mm-hmm. And look, we have 6 of a family, so It's what keeps us and sustains us. So it's very important to us that this actual housing order.
Right. Well, what does it mean to you? Were you shocked by that, or have you been worried anyway? Because we know there are ongoing concerns about bird flu and a number of outbreaks.
Yes. Look, we've had outbreaks in Cork and Carlow, and then in Northern Ireland, which is adjacent to us in Monaghan. There's outbreaks there as well, so or suspected outbreaks. So this housing order has been very, we welcome it, number one. Number two is, look, the birds that we keep on our farm are predominantly kept inside. They are kept inside all the time anyway. They're not exposed to outside environment. But the farmers that would have free-range broilers or free-range egg producers, they have to keep their birds locked up during this period to protect the birds and to protect their income in relation to what they're doing as well. Uh-huh. That's the main thing here, is protecting livestock and protecting family farms. That's okay. What this is all about.
So while this is worrying, a worrying time for anyone in the poultry industry, I'd say, Nigel, this is a good step, is it, this compulsory housing order? Because the big producers like you say, would have the chickens or the turkeys indoor. Anyway, will it help? Will it be enough to prevent the spread of bird flu, do you think?
Well, all we can do is belt and braces. And look, on poultry farms, we run very, very high biosecurity measures. Nobody gets into the farm unless it's between batches. Maintenance is carried out then. Meal deliveries, the gates are locked, so lorries coming in will be disinfected. Like, we're doing the very best we can, but people have to remember, avian influenza, it's a virus. And as a virus, we can't see it. That's the most distressing part of it for us as farmers, that no matter how much that we do, it is a virus. And birds flying overhead can land, they can have droppings there, and the droppings would contain avian influenza. And with that, how do we prevent that from getting into the house? If it's a virus, it will come in, and there's nothing we can do about it. But we can minimise the risk by taking all the precautions that we can reasonably do. And that is what we're doing at the minute.
You said you're farming about 100,000 chickens. You're in Monaghan, is it, Nigel?
Yes, we're in Monaghan.
And are you supplying Monaghan all over then, or where do the chickens go?
Well, the chickens that we rear, they wind up going, they go, I supply a company called Manor Farm in Shercock in Cavan. And they, in turn, will be supplying the likes of Supermax, supplying Tesco, Dunn Stores and all the multiples. So, look, there's a huge knock-on effect if it gets in. And, look, the farmers that would have... But I'm going to... Look, we as farmers are doing the very best we can. But I'm going to say, you know, to your listeners, they need to be very, very aware of... There's a huge amount of people out there that have backyard flocks with 5 or 6 chickens sitting out there and getting a few eggs, and I'm not condemning that, and if people want to do that, fair play to them. But when the commercial guys such as ourselves are doing everything we can to minimise the risk, it's not fair on us that when you have people that would have, let's say, six or eight or four chickens in the backyard, they're not locked up, and they're potentially have a huge knock-on effect for us, because if somebody has six chickens and lose one chicken or two chickens, they might not think that much of it. But the knock-on effect of that have, the virus been in the area, the virus been in the air, it could spread to a commercial farm because of that there, or fox come in and take it away. Like, it's, these are the problems. We can have very high biosecurity measures on farms, but how do you do the same with a backyard flock? Mm-hmm. That's the difficulty, because most people have them running around the garden, or they have a pen and they're locked up facilities for them. Is, I don't know how adequate it would be or wouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. It's 51551 if listeners want to get in touch, or 0818715815 to call us on Liveline. And I'm sure we have people out there, many, this is a huge industry in Ireland, Nigel, from the people raising 100,000 birds to the backyard free-range farms, or people just with a few chickens in the garden. What are you saying to them, soldier? They need to lock up their birds too.
They need to lock up their birds. These are the first people that need to lock up the birds, because these are the people that are the, these are the birds that are most exposed of the entire, of the whole lot. If you look down in Cork, that wildlife park.
Photo Wildlife Park, yeah.
Yeah, Photo Wildlife Park.
It's a great place.
I was caught in that. You know, like, it's a fabulous place and mm-hmm. a great place to go. But the problem was, because the birds were outside, they got exposed because of migratory birds. So if that happened in Photo Wildlife Park, what's to say that's not happening and is not happening in, you know, around the country mm-hmm. as we speak, in backyard flocks?
And Nigel, it sounds like you, because of the size and what's at stake in your farm as well, you've already taken lots of precautions. Your birds are indoors. Can you keep the virus out now, do you think, the bird flu out of your farm?
I can only do the best that I can in relation to the precautions that I take. As I previously said, mm-hmm. it's a virus,
yeah.
number one. You can't see a virus. We've seen from COVID days, you know, what a virus can and cannot do. We can't see it. Birds are flying overhead. If they land down, if the droppings, we are taking, if the droppings comes to say the vent and the air has been taken into the shed, so I can't say what will or will not happen. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what I do when I come to my shed is, I come to the shed, I take my footwear off, I change my footwear going into the shed, and I put on other footwear actually when I'm going into the boards. So I do changes of clothes, change the footwear continuously. I disinfect lorries that are coming in. We do all these precautions. So all I'm asking is that, you know, we can do, we can get over this as long as we all work together in terms of what we do as farmers and what other people that keeps hobby boards equally do the same. And look, this type of thing of, you know, where you've guys with pigeons and pigeon fanciers and that, and birds coming over from, let's say, the UK, being left off in Ireland and flying back to England or whatever it is. All these things have to be stopped at the minute as well, you know. Mm-hmm. That's what's it. And look, the other thing is, if a farmer gets it, there is, you know, a compensation package for that. But, you know, the National Poultry Chairman, Nigel Sweeten, he's trying to set up, he wants to set up a disease fund that would be funded by both the farmers and the Department of Agriculture, that if a farmer does have a problem, a disease or something comes in, that there's a fund there that will help that farmer
to support them, because this could be very costly. Nigel, I see what you're saying. It's 51551. You remind us of a time, I suppose, of the foot and mouth precautions on farms as well, when you talk about footwear. But I think you don't let anyone else come into your farm that doesn't need to be there. Is that how it works?
Yes, we don't let anybody into the farm, but we have some of these guys going around, these what they call animal welfare, you know, activists going about the countryside as well. And look, people need to bear in mind that that if you are an animal welfare activist, mm-hmm. you know, like, do us all a favour and stay away from poultry farms at the minute, because these people, whereas they think they're doing the right thing, could actually come in and decimate, okay. you know, a huge amount of poultry within an area of the country mm-hmm. by coming in you know, onto people's farms mm-hmm. that's not invited. Gates are closed, but that doesn't stop these people.
Okay.
They just come
and
in.
And I hear your fears. We don't want to lock up the whole countryside, I suppose, but I know there's a lot at stake here for you as well. 51551, if any of those people want to get in touch too. Michael, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
I'm well. And yourself? Tell me about your situation on your farm.
Oh, sure, I suppose. How could you be when news like this breaks? But I suppose as you just have to deal with it when it comes out. It's becoming more of a regular and more often. This happens nearly every year now, so it does. And I was saying...
You sound like
on,
a very young... Michael, you sound like a very young poultry farmer.
I'm actually only 19 myself. I'm here in ATU College in Galway.
Good man.
I'm doing an ag science course in Mount Bellew, and we're one day a week here in Galway. So that's just where I am at the minute now.
And will there be chickens at home on the farm for you? Were there always, or is it just something you've got into?
During COVID, I actually got an incubator and begun trying to hatch quail, followed by hens and so on and so forth, until I started getting into the more purebred breeds and started going towards the more of the showing side of the industry, showing at local agricultural shows and poultry specific shows up, let's say over towards Dublin and stuff like that. So we'd be mainly, we wouldn't be as commercial, we wouldn't have the 100,000 birds there, but we'd have over 150 birds there at the minute, and we would do a small level of commercial. We would do a few Christmas turkeys, and we would do a few hybrid laying hens at the back end, but we'd mostly be pointing towards the side of showing hens. And it's just so devastating that something like this has came in, because it has a massive impact on obviously, like, your biosecurity has to be so much higher, and the other side of it too is it really affects the younger people trying to get into the showing industry, because you spend all year preparing your birds for these shows, and just as it's coming to the time for your time to shine, one of these lockdowns tends to come in nearly every year now at this stage. And
Michael, can I ask about
it? Really turns people off.
The 150 birds you have, and they're rare breeds, you said, and you're breeding them for shows as well, or also raising turkeys for Christmas. Do they roam freely on your farm?
They would roam in an outdoor area, so they would have. They would have an indoor house then for night time.
Will you put them in now, this compulsory housing order for poultry
Absolutely,
and captive
yeah,
birds?
Sure. Compulsory order, sure. And it's the indoor birds that are, the show birds are kept indoors full times anyway, and they're only brought out to during the summer, say, because they would be rather delicate. But it's just the fact that none of these birds can be brought to the shows now, and like, it's a big social outlet for poultry farmers on the small scale across the country, and it's an awful pity that people won't be able to exhibit this year.
But you understand why, Michael, from what you're saying. You're worried about the birds as well.
Absolutely. Like, sure, it really affects the health of the birds, especially when they're not, like, obviously on the commercial scale. These birds would be... It'd be washed on a regular basis and blow dried and prepared for shows, and like, you can just see how sad they get when they're locked indoors at all times. They tend to have their comb and wattles tend to go rather pale, and they also tend to not, the shine on their feathers doesn't tend to be as good, and it has such a huge impact on a part of the industry that a lot of your listeners wouldn't be. A lot of listeners wouldn't be aware of, if you get me. Like, I know everyone thinks instantly poultry is the chicken you get in Supermax or the pack of chicken you buy in Dunnes, but it's not. Like, there's this whole...
But you're worried about the birds. You're worried about how this affects them and their welfare. Nigel, what do you think of that?
No, I think he's absolutely right in terms of keeping birds in. Look, everybody... Like, I'm a very commercial producer. Let's not... We're going to get straight to the point here. And for birds to perform for me and to generate an income for both my wife and I and the family, I need to keep the birds in the best possible environment that I can keep them in. Mm-hmm. And the better I look after the birds and the better the environment that I create for them birds, the better the birds will perform. Mm-hmm. I know, look, and that, I'm just speaking commercially, And in relation to that there, that's what we do. And we have very high levels of food conversion, and birds do very well.
But Michael, you think they do better outside, is it? Access to outside?
To be honest, I wouldn't contradict what Nigel is saying when it comes to the commercial side of the industry. And I even see it myself there when I do a certain level of the Christmas turkeys and stuff like that. The more controlled you can have the environment and the temperature and the bedding and the feeding and the airflow and all of that, the healthier your bird will be, and therefore it has a knock-on effect to the productivity of the birds for the commercial setup. So,
You're in agreement on that, so, Nigel?
Oh, absolutely. Look, he's hit the nail on the head completely. The hybrid birds that he has in terms of the pure breeds, there are different. Look, all our birds come back to, let's say, white leghorns and different things like that. There, that's like, so it's the pure of the breed. Do you know what I mean? They're a different animal. They're not a different animal. They're not a different species, but they're bred differently for different traits. And I suppose, effectively, a bird all came from the jungle at one point or another. So the hardiness of them, you know, we go for different traits. Most people want breast meat, so the broilers that I would have are bred specifically, you know, for a lot of breast meat. So the other birds that would have to be outside are bred for different traits in terms of eggs or in terms of hardiness for different things. So it's just the same as cattle, you know what I mean? If you're a double muscle, you know, Belgian blue versus a Holstein cow, you know what I mean?
There's different
folks.
Uh-huh. Michael, what's your plan once you're out of college? Are you going to get into this in a bigger way? Do you see yourself breeding chickens on a more commercial basis or turkeys?
To be totally honest, John, I can't see myself going to the commercial side of the industry. You see, I run a pumpkin patch there every Halloween, Michael's Pumpkin Patch, and it's rather interesting to have a smaller number of the pure breeds and educating the younger kids, like even from 3 and 4, there's such a huge interest when they come every Halloween and so even we do an event there at Easter as well. And it's the interest of wanting to learn and the eager to learn. Mm-hmm. And like you hear people there, the people who are at it for decades, and you'll often hear them say they were growing up around birds, whereas a lot of kids nowadays wouldn't be. So it's such a huge thing to me to having the smaller number and a variety of different purebred breeds and keeping them to a show standard rather than for a commercial industry and therefore for kids to see and as the man says develop their interest and their knowledge on the birds.
Fair play to you, Michael. You're trying new things anyway as well, which is very interesting to hear. 51551 if other listeners want to get in touch on this, or 0818715815. Alana, how are you?
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And yourself?
Oh, good, good, yeah.
Do you raise chickens yourself?
I do, yeah.
How many have you got? I
17 at the minute.
17 hens. Are they in your back garden or where?
Oh, they'd be in the back garden but locked in now.
Uh-huh. Are you worried about this bird flu scare, and what do you think of this compulsory housing order just announced for poultry this lunchtime?
Of course, like any poultry owner, you'd be scared of the avian flu, but you're just like you care about the hens so much. So if it's compulsory, it's compulsory. You put them in, keep them safe.
So you keep them fenced in anyway. Are they outdoors, though, or how does it work?
Yeah, we have kind of an outdoor pen, but she's fully fenced, and we have a roof on the top. So they're getting fresh air and daylight, but they're completely sealed.
So you'd regard that as a compulsory housing order, that you'd meet the criteria there, would you?
I believe I would, so yes.
And would you be worried? You heard Nigel there saying he's worried about the people with the few hens in the back garden, that they might not take the cautionary steps or the preventative measures to help the industry and to help other farmers in general.
Of course, yeah. I mean, even your small keepers, you need to be aware that birds spread it, so keep your birds in. Do you know what I mean?
You're happy to go along with that?
Oh, of course. I'm doing my part.
What do you do, Alana? Do you just keep the hens for the eggs, or how does it work for you? Do you supply others?
Oh, yeah. Keeping them just for our own consumption here in the house, or we might barter for a few vegetables off someone else or something. at the eggs.
Oh, that sounds like a good idea. You give me half a dozen eggs, I'll give you a pumpkin if you're on Michael's farm, I'd say.
Yeah,
or maybe some carrots or turnips or something like that as well. It sounds like a nice system.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. The only way to do it on the small scale.
Well, long may you continue. Nigel, Alana is taking the steps needed there. She's protecting her 17 hens. What are you saying to everyone else out there, Nigel? Because you're talking about a massively important industry here, the poultry industry in Ireland.
Yeah, I just hope that everybody takes the same precautions as Michael and Alana in what they do, in terms of they obviously have a great interest in the birds that they have, and because of such an interest, they want to look after them as best as they possibly can, equally the same as I do. And I'm delighted to hear such young people actively, you know, keeping them and interested. It's great to hear that. I'm absolutely delighted to hear that. Mm-hmm. I'm actually delighted the fact that they're keeping them indoors, because they realise they don't want to lose the birds, and they want to keep them in the safest environment possible. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, they're protecting their own birds, and they're protecting themselves, and they're protecting the neighbours' birds as well, which is all any of us can ask from anybody.
Okay, and it's nice to hear a word about welfare from people there as well in terms of these animals, but a very important industry as well. This compulsory housing order for poultry and captive birds comes after the introduction of a restriction zone around a commercial turkey farm, of course, in Carlow yesterday, after an outbreak of the H5N1 strain of bird flu. And very, very worrying, of course, for turkey farming, for a big industry coming up to Christmas. Get in touch, please, if you it affects you as well, and for your thoughts. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
And 51551 for your texts or liveline at rte.ie. It's John Cook with you until 3 o'clock. Pam O'Loughlin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Pam, it's good to talk to you again, and thanks for talking to us on Liveline today. What does it mean when a jury inquest says that your sister, your little sister Emer, was unlawfully killed? It's 20 years ago, but those two words are very important, aren't they?
Extremely important. We've been waiting a long time for this, but it means a huge amount. A huge amount, because this is the first time that the Irish state have actually confirmed and admitted that Emer was unlawfully killed. She was murdered. Up until now, it's constantly been treated as a suspicious death. And just that uncertainty and not moving forward with the case, everything sort of combined just leaves you sort of sitting in a limbo. Mm-hmm. And I call this inquest. I requested it back in May, and just to move the case forward in a way, because again, it highlights the case, but also for the family to see if we could actually get a verdict where we could get people, six people in this case, to actually come to the conclusion that it was a murder and not just some sort of mysterious death. Mm-hmm. And we got that today.
For listeners who may not recall, or just to jog the memories of some as well, because the image of 23-year-old Emer, a beautiful young art student from County Clare, I think sticks with a lot of people who followed your story over the years. What happened to her, Pam?
Well, on the morning of the 8th of April 2005, it was the same day as Pope John Paul's funeral. Emer wasn't at college, so because of the funeral, so she was at home. And according to a witness, which was her boyfriend at the time, he went away to work. She was staying at home that day. Her phone was running out of battery. So she, between the two of them, they decided that she'd go over to a neighbour's to get the phone charged up. The neighbour lived in a mobile home, probably about 200 yards away from theirs. Mm-hmm. And he left for work, and that was the last time that Emer was seen alive. So then later on that day, some people that were going to the field discovered the smouldering remains, and they saw the remains in the fire of Emer. And then the guards were called, and from there it went on from there.
Do you remember getting that news 20 years ago, Pam? It must have been devastating.
It was absolutely devastating, yeah. I was actually not at home. I was looking after a friend's kennels and I was in charge of coming up to nearly 30 dogs. They were abroad and my brother John actually flew over to England to sort of tell me to my face, if you know what I mean. And so I was then in a situation where I was stranded. I couldn't leave. You know, it was absolutely devastating. I mean, my friends did come back from their holiday sooner and I did get to come to Ireland, but it was absolutely devastating. And the thing was, even then, there was so much uncertainty because at the time that I was told, all I was told was there'd been a fire, Eimear was missing, but a body had been found in the fire. So that was all that I knew at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was a very confusing time and absolutely devastating.
Mm-hmm. Will you stay with me? Because your dad, Johnny, is on the line as well. Johnny O'Loughlin, how are you?
Hiya, John.
Good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
You and I are...
Before you start...
Yeah, go on.
Before you start, fair juice to you. You were the first one ever that contacted me every year at our anniversary.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, Johnny,
I thank you for that.
You and I and Pam are lucky to live in a beautiful part of the world in County Clare. And I've met you in the at the foot of Mullaghmore Mountain in Ballyborna near Tubber, which is, for anyone who doesn't know, is just on the Clare-Galway border. It's a really beautiful place. It's where you see that spectacular swirling grey mountain of Mullaghmore. Yes. And it's where Eimear called home and hoped to build her house with her boyfriend in time. They were living in a mobile home at that stage. I've asked you many times, but it's important today as well, as you get this verdict from her inquest, that she was indeed the victim of an unlawful killing. Do you remember getting that news that day? What were you told?
Well, I got a phone call from her boyfriend that day around 4 o'clock, I think. I was just after leaving a quarry down in Innes. And he rang me and told me she was missing. No one knew it was her in the mobile home now. She was missing, and they were searching for her because she had the habit of taking photographs of her. But her dogs were loose, he told me, and he was kind of convinced that it was Eimear that was in the mobile home, because her dogs were around, her car was around, and her camera was around.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously they didn't believe it, you know. I went up that evening. And
you wanted to be part of the search. You wanted to help. But unfortunately, the devastating discovery was to come.
Yeah, I didn't realise it until I arrived above. You know. And then when I arrived above, no one asked me anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, it was a tragic, all right. And I'm delighted with the verdict today. I know it was fantastic.
Unlawful killing. Eimear did not die in a fire.
No.
The inquest, the post-mortem evidence given in the inquest today from the former deputy state pathologist, Dr. Michael Curtis, points to it being probable, but not absolutely certain. But they believe it probable her death was before the fire and that it was a violent death, which you have known. But sadly, it took a long time. It took a lot of answers. It took the exhumation of Eimear's body, even 5 years after you had laid her to rest.
Yeah.
It's been a very hard journey.
And fair juice, I
take your time, Johnny. Take your time. I let you catch your breath, Johnny. I know how upsetting. I know how upsetting it is. Take your time and catch your breath, Pam. Well, you had to campaign. Pam, you take your time, Johnny, and I let Pam do some of the explaining as well.
Yeah.
Pam, you. And your family have campaigned for a long time for justice for Eimear, but it even took 5 years to discover the true events of what had happened or how she had died.
Yeah, it did. I mean, we were sort of unaware or maybe just numb about the whole thing at the time, but at the time of the original funeral, she was buried without a cause of death.
Mm-hmm.
And that only really became apparent when I started to notice any reports that related to Eimear were all discussing her death, and nobody was using the word murder,
mm-hmm.
even though everybody involved in this knew it was a murder. So I started to question, how come we're not using the word murder in relation to Eimear? And it was when I was talking to the cold case squad And they said, well, we can't call it a murder because we don't know how she died. And it was then the gravity of the situation that this isn't officially a murder investigation. It is, you know what I mean? It's just a suspicious death investigation. And I did say to the cold case squad at the time, you know, dig her up, basically. And I think it was about a year, year and a half after that, that the decision was made to exhume her body. And we could then get the second post-mortem with the anthropologist involved. And the anthropologist was able to find details on the neck and the skull, mm-hmm. which pointed towards a violent death, and also burn patterns that wouldn't be obvious the first time round were more obvious on what was now bare bone. So, mm-hmm.
To explain a little bit your frustration as to not knowing the cause of death here, from very early on here, there was a suspect in this case because the mobile home, which belonged to a man named John Griffin, originally
That's
from
right,
Galway
yeah.
City, had been completely destroyed by fire. Emer's remains were found inside, and he was nowhere to be seen or found then or since, 20 years on.
Yes, yeah. And that's been a never-ending source of absolute frustration. You know, it's just sort of left us in a limbo for the last 20 years because, you know, even with the second post-mortem and the declaration that it now was a murder inquiry, he had a five-year head start.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, witnesses get older and, you know, people pass away, et cetera, et cetera. So every year that goes on, we're getting sort of further away from potentially getting an actual, you know, a proper verdict in front of a jury.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's been a never-ending source of frustration.
And
this is the reason why I try and keep it alive in the media as much as I possibly can, because just one day somebody might decide, you know what, I've heard enough about this and I know where this guy is and I'm going to tell the guards, you know.
You believe he's still out there?
Oh, he's definitely out there. There's absolutely no doubt whatsoever. He did not jump off a cliff in Inishmore. He did not commit suicide. That man is alive. We know he is alive. I can't discuss how or when or whatever, mm-hmm. but he is alive. He is out there. And, you know, the only thing that actually helps me sleep at night is that he spends every single day looking over his shoulder, every single day. And we just need that one day where... Mm-hmm. You know, he takes a wrong step or somebody recognises him or somebody comes forward that knows where he is. That's all that we need.
You refer to his last sighting on the last official sighting, which Gardaí confirmed, the last confirmed sighting of John Griffin was on the Aran Island of Inishmore. They believe he may have information that will assist them and are eager to interview them as part of their investigation. This is what they said in April mm-hmm. on the 20th anniversary of Emer's death. And they believe that his clothes folded on the cliff edge and other circumstances were an effort to frustrate their investigations, that he is out there and someone knows and perhaps somebody can help. Can I bring it back to Emer? And Johnny, I'll bring you back in as well, because you've never given up hope of finding the man responsible here. You've never given up hope of finding justice for Emer, but she's your beautiful little girl as well, as I mentioned, if you don't mind me saying. Will you describe her to me? Because for our listeners as well, they've seen beautiful images of her, this a free spirit, if I might say, an artist. She was enjoying life and had big plans from her home in the Burren, an art college in Galway. Describe her to me, will you?
Well, she was a little dot. I thought Pamela was a little dot when she was small. She was unreal altogether. You know, and she loved art and she loved photography. And she was always happy and, you know, always smiling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and one thing I have to say then, I was thanking Amelia for all the hard work she had done.
Yeah. It's been a long road. She had a huge love of nature, as you said. She was sketching and drawing in the Burren and a beautiful surrounding there to inspire any artist or any person as well. She had her dog. Yeah. She loved animals as well. She had a lot of respect for life. It's very hurtful, I'm sure, to live with what happened to her.
It is. It is. I find that when I'm grand, all right, but when you start talking about it, I get awful emotional.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Of course.
I don't cry normally, but, you know, today really set me back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very understandable, I'm sure. Pam, it's been a very long road. She was your little sister, as you said. You were devastated in England to know that you were far from home and far from your little sister when this happened. How do you remember her?
Well, I mean, I left home at 16 for the UK, so Emer was still very, very young. So I really watched Emer growing up in increments, you know, every time I came home. So I just remember her. I mean, she could sing, lovely Rosa Clare before she could string together a full sentence, you know, that sort of thing. Very musical. She was lovely. And every year I'd come home, she'd be slightly bigger and she'd be changed. And, you know, she was just lovely and arty and, you know, just an absolutely lovely girl. And, yeah, I mean, as I say, I watched her grow up from a distance, but we did keep in contact. And
you must feel robbed of so much, Pam, because I'm thinking that's a common story for a lot of families and through emigration in the 80s and 90s as well. Mm. She had big plans for a good life. You were to come home as well. This should have been your little sister that grew up as your good friend and companion through life.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, she was taken from us, and that's what we actually put on her gravestone. You know, we said Emer O'Loughlin taken from us on the 8th of April. And, you know, we've no idea what sort of life she would have had. You know, she could have had a kid by now. It's just robbed our whole family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why I've done this for 20 years. Because I just, you know, I just felt that I just couldn't sit back and leave it. I had to push it. Because we were robbed. We were robbed of an absolutely beautiful human being. And today, at least, we got some bit of justice in that finally it was recognised that she was murdered. She just didn't die in some accidental fire or some mysterious way. And that, for us, is huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that does mean a lot.
And I get that from you. Something you said to me previously that struck me is you said people will always remember Emer. You want them to know she was not the girl who died in the fire. You can say that today loud and clear, and the headlines go out there loud and clear. You want people to know that, and you want them to do something about it if they can.
Exactly. You know, that has always been the thing. You know, everybody, as I say, when they talk about Emer O'Loughlin, they go, oh yeah, she died in the fire. And it's like, no, she didn't. So, you know, today to actually have that officially said, that no, you know, there was violence involved, there was somebody else involved, and this wasn't some freak accident. So that does mean a lot. And as I say, it's been a long time coming. But, you know, we are absolutely delighted with the verdict today from the jury. And, you know, I'd like to thank Isabel O'Dea, who's the Clare County Coroner, who responded when I did request for this inquest, and she did respond straight away and got it organised. So, yeah.
The coroner recording a verdict of unlawful killing within the last hour. So I appreciate you talking to us straight afterwards as well. As I mentioned it to you, the evidence of the former deputy state pathologist, Michael Curtis, said it was probable that Emer was dead before the fire. And you got to ask him if her injuries were consistent with deliberate violence by another person. Mm-hmm. His reply simply, yes. But it's so important that people know that today. Yeah. And it's so important that now that this investigation can progress. Or do you think it can, Pam?
Yes, I mean, yes, it can progress. And the thing is that the verdict today won't affect the investigation at all. But the hard thing about today is that the way that the coroner system is set up in Ireland, the actual burden of proof for an unlawful death is at the same level of the burden of proof for proving someone has committed a murder. So it can be very difficult to get an unlawful death verdict out of an Irish coroner's court. So the reason why I asked that question of Dr. Curtis, I also asked the same question of the anthropologist and a very similar question to the detective in charge of the case. I wanted all three of them to confirm that there was another individual involved in that death. And all three did confirm. So that left Coroner O'Dea with the ability to be able to direct the jury to an unlawful killing. Mm-hmm. So that is the reason why I asked those three questions, to sort of pave the way for Miss O'Dea to be able to direct the jury that way, and thankfully she did, and we got the verdict we did.
Mm-hmm. You're referring to the evidence of Dr. Loreen Buckley, a forensic anthropologist, yes, who carried out the second post-mortem examination after Emer's remains were exhumed in May of 2010, also giving evidence today, and the verdict of the coroner, Isabel O'Dea, there in Clare today in the court in Kilrush, of unlawful killing, as she sympathised with you. After this verdict, you, the family of Emer O'Loughlin, the Gardaí also offering their condolences as well. And we know that the Gardaí renewed their appeal on the... I'm reading from their official statement from April of this year, on the 20th anniversary of the murder of Emer O'Loughlin in Tubber in County Clare. Do you have information which may assist with the investigation? Have you seen or spoken to John Griffin, also known as Fuzzy Griffin, at the time or in the intervening years? Do you know his current whereabouts? Please come forward. Gardaí believe John Griffin is still alive, and at the time of his disappearance, he was assisted by person or persons unknown in leaving the island of Inishmore. Gardaí have never received a missing person report in respect of John Griffin, and 20 years later, they believe he is still out there. So, Pam, there may be people listening, and Johnny, that know he's still out there, or maybe he's heard your appeals over the years. John Griffin, what would you say?
What if I was speaking to John Griffin? Sorry, go on,
Johnny.
Go on,
first. Go on. There, yeah.
No, I definitely believe he's out there, but the way I look at it, why did he leave if he wasn't involved? Like, that's the question I have. If he wasn't involved, why didn't he stay? You know.
And to whoever might have helped him, or to him himself, or someone knows the what happened here, what is your appeal today, Johnny?
Well, I appeal anyone that knows where he is, or have contact with him, to contact the Gardaí. He's gone on 20 years now, and you know, he's still out there. Will he do it again? You know. So anyone that's out there that knows something about him, knows where he is, someone knows where he is. But I appeal to all of them to come forward.
The Gardaí said in their statement that John, also known as Fuzzy Griffin, is described as being 5'11" in height. He would now be 57 years of age. He's of slight build and bald on the top of his head. He often had a beard, which was shaved on occasion. He had a distinctive tattoo, an Egyptian Eye of Horus tattoo on his throat, or I think his Adam's apple area. He speaks with a local accent. Pam, you believe he's out there. You believe somebody listening might know where he is, or that maybe he's heard your appeals over the years. What do you say?
I wouldn't appeal directly to him at all. I have read the full pathology reports on the autopsy of my sister, so I will not appeal directly to him, but I will appeal directly to people who may know him or know of his whereabouts, to do the right thing and just ring the guards up anonymously. You don't have to give your name, just ring them up anonymously and let them know they will investigate, and they do investigate every single lead that comes in. And that's really the only appeal I can make at this point.
And we're here. I hear you loud and clear on that, Pam. Johnny, do you think you'll get justice for Emer?
We will. We will. But we don't know when. Will, as Phil says, will I be around to get it? I hope I am. You know, I hope I am around to see justice.
Pam,
her,
I know. I know.
Her mother won't be around, but I'm hoping I'll be around to see justice.
Sadly, I know Emer's mum has passed as well. Yeah. Pam, you want to see justice. You need to see justice.
Well, yes. Yeah. She didn't deserve this. She needs justice. We all need justice. And, we'll never give up. We'll never give up looking for it. And we think we will get it one day. It's just a case of him being in the wrong place at the wrong time, somebody spotting him, or somebody actually growing a conscience and deciding to make that phone call to say they know where he is. So,
Pam and Johnny, you're just coming out of that inquest in Clare. Thank you so much for your time today. Well done to you for your efforts. You've never let this go, and I know you can't. And I hope that you do get justice for Emer O'Loughlin, your beloved sister, your beloved daughter, Johnny, as well. Well done to you both, and thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, John.
On Liveline today.
Thank you very much.
Anyone with information who can help Gardaí in the ongoing 20-year investigation into the murder of Emer O'Loughlin. You've heard the appeals from her sister and her father there. A verdict of unlawful killing finally returned in her case 20 years after her death in the Burren, her violent death in the Burren today. Anyone with information can contact Gort Garda Station in County Galway on 091 636 400, and the Garda confidential line is 1-800-666-111, 1-800-666-111, or any Garda station. Please help them if you can.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
And on WhatsApp, we're 087 484 8888. It's John Cook with you until 3. Aoife, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, John. How are you yourself?
I'm good. Thanks very much for joining us today. Have you just been evicted?
Yeah, so I received my third letter of termination of tenancy in 4 years.
Evicted three times. You've lost your rental property three times. Through no fault of your own, I don't think, Aoife.
No. I've never missed a rent payment. I've never caused any trouble to the house. It's just a landlord that keeps selling the house, so we're giving it to a family member. And we just find ourselves in this situation yet again. It's extremely frustrating, and you have to pack up your whole life and then try and find somewhere else, only for it to be done again. Like, it's painful, to be honest.
Is you mentioned we're in this situation again. Is there you and others affected here?
So I house share. So I rent a room in a house. So in the first house, there was four of us affected. Second house, there was six of us affected. And then in this house, there's four of us affected again.
Mm-hmm. And you're all in a similar boat, are you? You're working or what's the, in Dublin, you're renting?
Everyone of us is working. And like, we work relatively good jobs. We're all single. So therefore, like, it's just getting increasingly more difficult for us to find somewhere to live.
You're young professionals, I suppose, is how people describe you, in your late 20s or early 30s, is it?
Yeah, early 30s. I wish we were in our late 20s.
No, you're still young. You're still young, Aoife. Don't worry. What happens to that dynamic all the time? Do you make good friends when you're renting, and then all of a sudden things get split up again when you have to move on somewhere else?
That's the thing about renting a room in Dublin. Like, when you're a single person, you don't know the type of house that you're going into. Sometimes you make good friends, but sometimes you feel unsafe. It really is like Russian roulette when you pick a house share, like, because everyone's nice the first time you meet them.
Mm-hmm. I'm only laughing because I'm thinking sometimes you do make good friends, but you don't know what you're facing as well. Like, it's difficult having to do this change over and over again, and it does get harder as you get a little bit older, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Like if you look at it, I wrote as a little girl that I would have my house, I would be married, I'd have my first kid by now. And, like, I still want those things. But, like, how unfair of it would it be for me to bring a child into this world if I don't have a home for them?
So this,
like I understand that there's a lot of people in that situation, and it's really unfortunate, and it's not fair on them, and it's not their fault. It's just, where is the hope in any of this?
So this was your goal. You were renting. I don't even know if it's possible, given how high rents have gone in Dublin and many places, to be able to rent and save money to try and buy a house or move towards something more stable. Is it, Aoife?
It's getting increasingly more difficult. And it's not even just trying to rent and save. It's trying to find somewhere safe to rent is the issue nowadays. Like in the last 2 months, I've been to 9 house viewings. The last 3 house viewings, there's about 40 people there. Like, and some of those, like, it's a small one-bed apartment or a studio apartment. Some of the people that are coming to those viewings are families.
Right.
And it's really hard to compete as a single person.
Uh-huh.
I looked up the statistics before talking to you, and it's like, out of the 16,353 people that are homeless, 7,170 of those are single adults. Uh-huh. And then 1,950 of them are young adults. So So that bit, like under the age of 24, it's the single income people that are really, really struggling. Mm-hmm. Even families, like there's a been a massive increase since 2015. Like it's doubled the amount of families in homeless accommodation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
And this isn't even including the people that are in emergency accommodation.
Mm-hmm. And the children, 5,000 to 6,000 of them now at this stage, the numbers going in one direction, it seems. When you heard the headlines today then from the Department of Finance and this report telling us that we're going to have another 15 years of a housing crisis, that high demand for housing won't reach its peak until the early 2030s, pent-up demand won't be fully eliminated until at least 2040. How do you feel about that, Aoife?
It's just a punch in the stomach, really. Like, I feel like people in Ireland, like your average people in Ireland are just getting kick after kick after kick. Like, if you look at it, house prices since from 2015 to now, or to the end of 2024, house prices to buy have risen by 91%. Rent prices have risen by 78%. Like, cost of living has risen by 23%. Yes, the average increase in income is 46%. Like, how are we supposed to manage? And they're saying, oh, yes, like we've been through similar situations before. I understand that there's been hardships before. But where is the hope? Like, where are the governments trying to fix these problems for the people that are being massively impacted by them? Like, our mental health numbers are increasing. Like, it's just so infuriating and frustrating because we keep getting promises. Like, they promised to deliver 33,000 homes last year. Mm-hmm. They fell short of that. And it's one of our major issues. They only built 30,300 homes. They fell short by 3,000 homes. And they predict that by 2030 to go up to 60,000 homes per year. They need an increase of 50,000 labor force to do that. Mm-hmm. Which are, why would they be working here when they can go abroad like family members have done, like other people have done, to have a better life for themselves, to make a better wage. Like there's no incentives for people to stay, for people to like work towards this. Like if you look at it, it's predicted that the amount of people to actually quit work and give up completely is to rise between now and 2030. Because people just are working, like myself, working multiple jobs, and there's no end. There's no end. And then for the Department of Finance to come out and say, oh, yeah, it'll be another 15 years, and this isn't even the height of it. We're at breaking point as it is.
Do you think you'll ever own a house, that goal you had in your mind for your 30s, Aoife?
Like, it's absolutely heartbreaking because I wish it was easier. I wish I could say that I do have hope in owning a house in the next 5 years so I can start a family and be happy and be content and hit those milestones a little later than I would have liked, but still hit those milestones. But I'm losing hope. I'm genuinely losing hope.
It's upsetting, isn't it, Aoife?
It's upsetting. It's frustrating. It's debilitating. And it's infuriating. The people of Ireland are angry. And, like, a lot of the time that anger is now being misplaced. But it's because it's just getting worse. It's an anger that doesn't seem to have a solution. It doesn't seem to be a priority for the people that are supposed to protect us, the people that are supposed to have our best interests at heart. Where are they? Because they're not in government.
Well, the government tells us that housing is their number one priority, as it has been in the past, but with a new focus, they tell us this time, a new housing plan to come in the coming weeks as well. And maybe they need to hear the reality from these Department of Finance statistics as well, saying that that the pent-up demand won't be fully eliminated for another 15 years. And they do mention as well what you say in terms of the tens of thousands of construction workers that are needed as well. Is this the wake-up call? Can something change from this?
But, like, where are the incentives for people to go into trades? Where are the incentives? Like, an apprentice wouldn't be able to afford living in Ireland. Like, where are the incentives for people to stay here? Like, I just don't understand. And I don't want to be a negative Nancy and just be complaining all the time
No, you're okay.
and upset by it. But like, unfortunately, this is my reality, and this is the reality for so many people. Mm-hmm. If you look at it, the average person under the age of 35 is living at home with their parents.
The average person under the age of 35, you said, living at home with their parents. That's a situation for a lot of your friends.
Yeah, no. Over 50% from the statistics, consensus. Over, I think it was 63%. I'm not 100% sure on that.
No, I think you're right. Certainly it's a trend that has changed a lot in the last few years. It's 51551, by the way, if listeners want to get in touch on this, or 087-484-8888 on WhatsApp. We'd love to hear your situation as well. Is that the situation your friends are talking about? I'm moving home with mom and dad, or I might never get to move out from them at all.
Yeah. I know a few people that have built cabins in the back of their family homes, and now they're paying off them. But sure, that's another expense that's going to get them further away from owning a house. It's just that's a better alternative to living with a group of people that they may not get on with, or that they don't know, or that they clash with. Like, I wish I knew the solution. I wish there was more incentive, like a rent-to-buy scheme, rather than these vulture funds coming over and profiting off basic human needs, basic human rights. If you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this is a foundational block in our well-being. And it's just missing. It's missing for so many people, so many families. And it's not good enough. 15 years is not good enough.
You're about to leave your third... Did you say your third shared home in how many years? 4 years?
4 years.
Mm-hmm. Did you strike up friendships there? I'm just wondering, is this something you talk about together? Or what has this done to the social life, to how people interact and I suppose to how everyone's getting on in these situations as well, when it's becoming a much more long-term prospect that you would have to keep moving from one house to the other, or that there isn't stability there?
What social life? Like, how can you afford to live in Ireland and have a social life at the same time? Like, yes, there are plenty of options, but like, you have to weigh up. Like, it's which do you want more? Do you want to have a fulfilling youth? Do you want to go out and go to events? Do you want to be able to live a wholesome, like, exciting, traveling life, or do you want to own a home? Because you can't. It's very, 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 very difficult. Only a very small proportion of our population can do both. Like, if you look at it, the cost of a pint in Dublin, now I'm not a big drinker, but the cost of a pint in Dublin is, it has gone, before 2020, it was €5 for a pint of Guinness. You'd be lucky to pay €7 now. Mm-hmm. Like, and then these house parties, sure, no one has a house to have a house party. So many people are getting to health and wellness because... like, it is a gym membership. Run clubs, often they're free. Mm-hmm. Like, people are looking for social outlets that doesn't drive them away from their goals, doesn't drive them away. And, like, I'm not advocating for people to go out and drink, and I'm sure there's plenty of other things, but, like, we're told as young people, oh, maybe skip the cup of coffee, then you'll be able to afford a home. Maybe skip a €5 cup of coffee, and then if you keep doing that, then you'll get a house one day.
It sounds like you're already making much bigger sacrifices than that, Aoife.
Yeah. I just feel...
The social life, like, is gone, is what you're saying. You're trying to save. You're working as much as you can.
I some days I work 12, 13 hours and multiple jobs.
Really?
Like, I left. I was selling alcohol as my job, and... morally, I wanted to make a move to make a difference because I could see our growing mental health numbers. I wanted to be a voice that I needed as a young person, a voice of hope. And I'm very lucky that over COVID, when everywhere was closed, I went back to college. I studied. I worked part-time. I continued to try and educate myself. I now work in the disability services on a mental health course. Sorry, a wellness course.
Right.
And I get paid significantly less as I would selling alcohol.
It's frustrating, isn't it, Aoife?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish I had the solution. I genuinely do.
I wish I did too. But I wish I did.
This is my real life. Like, I'm going to... like, and also the fact that I am partially self-employed. that makes it 10 times difficult, more difficult for me to be selected in the rental climate, because even though I've had like three of those contracts for over 3 years, they're stable incomes. Like they are afraid to accept myself over somebody that like maybe works in tech or has a permanent contract.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to do the right thing. I try to make a move. I am privileged that I now get to have a positive impact on people's lives. However, at what cost?
Well done. Well done, Aoife. You're trying your best, but what are you going to do now?
I just feel like I'm being punished for trying to make a difference. And I just feel like the people that should care don't.
Would a more stable rental market help you, do you think? Because the government does tell us that, as well as focusing on the provision of extra houses, many thousands of them, building more homes, they're looking at changes in the rental market as well and giving longer term tenancies, stability to tenants like you as well. Would that help?
But that's what's driving the increase in evictions, because the small landlords, the single landlords, are getting punished left, right and centre. So like if someone, like they're getting taxed nearly 50% of the income, small landlords, the people that are housing these, mm-hmm. these like groups of people like myself. Like if you look at big corporations, like there's loads of apartment complexes being built like around where my mom
yeah.
lives. Like they're being bought over by big corporations and they're being rented out. Like the rents there are 2,200, 2,600 for a one bed apartment.
Right.
Like what couple would be able to afford that comfortably, let alone a single person?
Uh-huh. And we do need more apartments, and we need the foreign investment as well. But I'm interested in something you said there as well, because as we move towards tighter controls on the rental sector or new rules that would give longer term tenancy, 6 year tenancies in some cases to tenants renting. And I think that landlords wouldn't be able to use the excuse of we're selling the house as a reason to evict you. Are you saying that's what's happening now, is that a lot of those landlords are cutting and running, we're just going, we're selling right now, that's why you're being evicted?
I don't think that's why I'm being evicted. However, I went to one of my employers, so like one of the people I'm contracted to, and I asked him, could you write me a letter of reference to say that I've worked here for the last 3 years, that I've had a value and that you're not going to get rid of me anytime soon? And he says, wow, you're the sixth person in the last 2 weeks to come and ask me for a letter.
Mm-hmm.
Since the government have released new tenancy laws. That's what he said.
So you believe this is happening, yeah.
Oh, like from what I've heard from people, so I had a TikTok that went viral of me opening the eviction notice. Like if you read through the comments, there is families, there are older people, there are young people. Like it's happening across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why 1.6 million people connected with that video, because it's not just an isolated incident. Like, we feel like we should be ashamed that we can't house ourselves at the moment. Like, I genuinely am upset that I'm in this situation, because it's embarrassing to admit that you're in this situation yet again.
Yeah.
And you start to wonder, what am I doing wrong? Like, I've paid my tax. I work hard. I'm trying to contribute to society. I'm part of my community. What am I doing wrong?
Aoife, it's not you, is it? I'm sorry that you're in this situation. It's 51551. It's a situation many people are in. If you want to get in touch, it's liveline@rte.ie or 0818715815. What are you going to do immediately in the short term, Aoife? Are you putting yourself through looking for rental rooms again in shared houses or what?
Yes, so I am currently on the hunt. Anyone knows anyone, let me know. No, I'm only joking.
I'd say you try anything at this stage, Aoife. Don't knock it. If anyone has a room for Aoife as well, 51551.
No, I'm trying to, like, I've just had a few bad situations in previous houses that I've lived in with tenants. So I just want a safe place to live. Like, that's what I'll be wishing, writing on my Santi list coming up to Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, I'm looking at studios, I'm looking at small one-bedroom apartments, I'm looking at smaller, like in rental properties, like renting a room, but I don't know if I can keep doing this.
Okay. I've more people getting in touch on housing. 51551. Aoife, so well spoken. Please stay with me if you can for a moment. And lots more getting in touch as well. It's 087 484 8888 on WhatsApp.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
And it's liveline at rte.ie or on WhatsApp for those stories about housing as well, 087 484 8888, because we are getting people in touch in this and I want to hear more of what Aoife has to say to us there, because we need to hear from those young people, as she said, in their 30s, who are now being told that 15 more years of the housing crisis is what we can expect. Your views need to be heard and we're here for them on Liveline. Liveline at rte.ie. Lorraine, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Lorraine. Tell us what's happening where you are. You're worried about the chickens or the turkeys, or which do you have?
Well, we have a little mixture of everything here at Daisy Cottage Farm. We have one turkey called Theo. He's with us for the last 8 years, and we have a couple of hens, all with names. Specifically, Roger the Rooster.
Roger the Rooster. Okay. Who else do you have on the farm?
We have Henny Penny, we have Jemima, we have, they all have names. And if you have a name in our farm, you don't get eaten. That's the rule.
If you have a name in our farm, you don't get eaten.
You don't get eaten.
How is that working out for you, Lorraine?
Oh, it's working out great. It's just, we try so hard to comply with all the rules and regulations, and you know, it's shocking to hear that turkey call over in Carlow, which is not very far from us at mm-hmm, all. Mm-hmm. And the devastation that must be to that farm. It's horrendous, because you do, it doesn't matter whether they're commercial or they're pets like mine, you do get attached to them. And, you know, there's a ritual going out in the morning, feeding them up, giving them fresh water.
Okay, where do you keep them, Lorraine?
And chat with them. We keep them in a house.
Are you going to be keeping them indoors, is what I'm wondering, under this compulsory housing order for poultry?
We will.
You heard Nigel earlier on, big producers saying that the smaller backyard poultry keepers as well need to be mindful here too.
Oh, we always adhere to the law, because it's a big thing, you know, especially when you see the producers so close to us.
Lorraine, you mentioned some very interesting names. What happened to Thelma and Louise?
Thelma and Louise. Well, first of all, Thelma went off with Foxy Loxy. And then I think Louise missed her so much, she went off with Foxy Loxy as well.
Oh, my goodness. This was not a rom-com. This was a Thelma and Louise type ending where the fox intervened and drove them off that cliff, did he?
Yes. He came. Well, she is a vixen.
Okay.
And she comes every year to have her babies across the field away from us.
Well, look, Lorraine, thank you for talking to me. Keep them locked up from the fox and from bird flu as well.
And from the bird flu, yes.
And thank you for talking to us on Liveline.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
And Liveline at rte.ie for your emails. Today's show was produced by Jack Murphy. Niall McMonagle was on sound and Laura Lee Davies was our broadcast coordinator. Thanks to you all for getting in touch and for listening. From me, John Cook, and all the Liveline team, have a great afternoon. Brendan Courtney's coming up next.